Okay, tonight is lesson number 18, and last week, just as a refresher, was, this might come as a shocker, last week was lesson number 17. Really, and tonight is number 18. That's just to let you know that I keep track of those things. And last week we talked about two heroes of the faith in Germany, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller, two against the flow. And then we talked about Soviet anti-Semitism and a little bit about Zionism and the modern state of Israel. Tonight, what I want to do, I want to cover a few things. I want to talk a little bit about the post-war collective guilt. So we want to talk about anti-Zionism. We'll talk about the first and second Intifada. The first one is 87-93. The second one is now known as the Palestinian War of 2000-2005. And we'll stop right there tonight, and next week we'll look at the, we'll have a whole session on the new anti-Semitism. But it doesn't mean that there is an exact date like 2005 or so where the new anti-Semitism was born. It could be argued that the new anti-Semitism, and we'll look at that next week in more details, really started to be formed out of the ashes of the old one, basically right after the war, right after 1945. It started to regroup and reorganize itself under a different guise, under a different facade, and that would end up being what it is today. Fine-tuned to what it is today, to the point where the whole world is buying it hook, line, and sinker, thinking they're doing the planet justice by hating Israel, and with that, all the Jews of all the world. So that's a simplification, but that's what we'll look at that next week. But I don't want you to think that it starts like a few years ago. None of that, especially the old anti-Semitism, none of that happened in a vacuum. Now you know, 2,000 years. It took 2,000 years to get to where we are. But copies of what? My notes? But be my guest. Be my guest. Okay, so part one, the post-war collective guilt. And still some of it going on a little bit today, but right after the war, it was definitely a big issue. By the end of the war, Germany was dealing with a tremendous amount of guilt as a result of the atrocity committed by the Nazis. Now, to be sure, I've said it before, I need to say it again, and we need to really, really remember that because it is so easy to paint with broad strokes and just put everybody in the same basket, but not all Germans were Nazis. We have a proof of that. Last week we talked about Martin Niemöller and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, part of the German, what's the word of that church? I can't remember the, I'm going to have to look it up now. German resistance, but the confessing church, that's what I'm talking about. We talked about those two pastors, part of the confessing church, and of course it was not just those two, those who followed them and many who maybe were not even Christians, but who had an understanding of people and humanity enough that they would want to help their neighbors if they were in trouble, Jewish or not Jewish. So not all Germans were Nazis, but Germany had been the fertile soil where Judeophobia grew like a weed of hatred, culminating in the Holocaust. So we have a lot of people still to this day. There are people that are grandchildren of Nazi officers that are scarred for life, psychologically messed up for life. You know, my great grandfather was a Nazi officer. How's that for legacy? You know, you're not, you say, show me your family history, your family picture book, you know, and you've got, well, this is grandpa, he worked for Hitler. You know, this is not the case for every German family, but there is still some of that, as we still have not that many, but survivors of the Holocaust. The same generation on the other side of the fence, we have to remember that. Survivors, you know, and children and grandchildren and great grandchildren of Nazis and Nazi officers and anti-Semite of the Second World War. So that's a reality. There was a declaration known as the Stuttgart, which is a town in Germany, Stuttgart Declaration of Collective Guilt, was proclaimed and published by the Council of the Protestant Church of Germany, and it included Martin Niemöller as a signatory. On October 19, 1945, this ecumenical document, now I'll stop right here because some of you are going to come to me and says, Olivier, are you pushing ecumenicanism, whatever the word is? No, I'm not in favor of it. I absolutely am not in favor of it. This is watering down of Christianity as we know it. But in the context of what they did, I see nothing wrong with it. Because when it came to the Holocaust and the Jewish people, we needed the whole world, if we could, to go against the acts of Nazi Germany. So this ecumenical document was meant to serve as a Christian witness to the world on how people were treated by Nazi Germany. While never mentioning Jewish people or the Holocaust by name, it was a small step in the right direction. I give you a link to the text of it. So it did not really, it was not a denunciation of the Holocaust and how the Jewish people had been killed and mistreated. It was a step in the right direction. Additionally, the declaration was more words than deeds, and it did not always sit right with the German people as a whole, who felt, rightfully so, that they also had suffered during World War II. Again, considering that not all Germans were Nazis, there were a lot of Germans who lost their life, who lost their property, who lost their family, who lost their whatever they lost, who suffered from the war. Okay, a lot of civilians. So we have to keep that in mind as well. I don't think it's balanced. I don't think it's, you know, as many Germans as Jews, but we're not looking at a balance here. We're looking at just the fact that after the war, there was a lot of guilt in the German, in Germany, and it created the Holocaust and the tragedy of the Jewish people in Nazi Germany became a taboo subject that nobody would dare discuss. Nobody would dare discuss. Jewish circles, or not Jewish circles, in general, they wouldn't dare discuss that. And then, of course, Germany went, still to this day, is paying for the horrors of the Holocaust. They have, there's still a lot of Jewish people that receive funds from Germany. Recently, my mother, she never looked for it, but recently they discovered, I'm not even sure who they are, they discovered that my grandfather, her dad, who was taken by the Gestapo, was for a short time, he was an antique dealer, but more of like a street peddler. He had a little cart with antiques and stuff. He would buy them for people that would just pass away, or that would move, or that would need. So he'd have a little shop on wheels. Well, that was worth something. It was about 5 or 7 years ago, they discovered that he owned this, and of course when he was taken to the camps, that was confiscated, and with the property and everything, and a value was put on that. I'm not a millionaire, okay, but a value was put on that, and my mother received a check from the German government based on the value of what had been taken away from her father when he was taken by the Gestapo. Sorry? Well, there are a lot of stories like this. Actually, the movie that I recommended you guys go see has a little bit of that perspective. That's not the whole story, but there is a part of the story is that. It's still, by the way, playing at the theater. I'm amazed it's still there. Saraski, if you haven't seen it, go see it. Saraski, go see it. It plays at the West Park 8 on Alton and Paseo West Park. No, of course it's not. You know, it doesn't bring back our father, but it doesn't hurt. It doesn't. And some people decide to put the money into a foundation or do something. Sorry? No. It was probably the equivalent of maybe, I think, between $5,000 and $10,000, something like that. But it was the fact that the point I'm trying to make, and I don't even know the exact amount, and she divided between the kids and grandkids. That's my mom. But the point I'm trying to make is here, 2011. So it was after 2000. It was in the 21st century. They're still paying. And my mother never was in the camps. Her mother was not in the camps. Her dad was taken to Auschwitz and died there. There's proof. I showed it to you last week in the book. So it's. I don't know how long it's going to go that way, but there's still restitution. Okay, so let's keep going here. This being said, the denazification, I'm not even sure it's a word, but I've seen it before, so I'm going to use it. The denazification of Germany was not a smooth process, as anti-Semitism didn't really disappear. Three-quarters of Germany still believe, that's after the war, that Jews were a different race, and about one-third felt that Germany would be better with no Jews at all. Now, when I say Jews are a different race, well, you can argue that the Jewish race is different from other we're different from other people, but the way it's being said here is not Jew is a different race, like that really doesn't belong. That's what is meant by Jews are a different race. Okay, it's beyond the come from a different part of the world, right? Not that far. And remember now, part of the collective guilt and part of the the remarketing, this is a bad word, but this is what you could look at it this way, the remarketing and the repackaging of anti-Semitism after the war, part of all that is to take away that negative image of racial anti-Semitism. It is no longer, you ask anybody who's an anti-Semite today, except for very small, minute fringe groups, like neo-Nazis all over the world, like little groups in America and Germany and anywhere, or some very even not all the Arabs believe that, not all the Muslims. Almost everybody will agree with you and say, no, we don't want the Jews. The Jews are not a subhuman race, although some of the propaganda you get from the Arab nations is pretty much that. But most of the civilized world will never play that card again, because that's just, you can't do that. That's not going to fly. Nobody's going to want to go with that. It's just not proper. So the racial card was played for the last time by Hitler, and it's done. Small groups are still doing it, but they're really not a major part of the. The guy on the street. Oh yeah, and he's not the only one, but he's not. But those are not major groups. But it still doesn't take away anti-Semitism. But the main aspect of anti-Semitism is no longer racial now. It's Israel in the way of the world peace, and of course Israel includes all the Jews, not just of Israel, but everywhere. So a Jew like me and where I live. I got to be careful. I don't want to say I'm being recorded, so I don't want to say where I live. A Jew like me, wherever I live, even though I might not live in Israel, I'm still part of the problem because I'm Jewish. It's ridiculous. Anyway, so Germany now, split between East and West Germany, was also split on its support of Israel or lack of. East Germans felt that Israel was acting as an imperialist state and thus couldn't receive their support, while West Germany made every effort to repair the damages and support the Jewish people, including reparations to Israel and the Jews that to date amount to $55 billion. Not million, billion dollars. When you think about it, it's probably not that much. But it's a big number anyway. Other European countries shared in the guilt, so much so that anti-Semitism and the Holocaust became taboo subjects that one would avoid at any cost. The phrase "never again" became the Jewish motto as an almost eradicated people was regrouping and populating or repopulating Israel. For a while, one could almost believe that anti-Semitism was gone. As a matter of fact, the 1960s witnessed several events that led many to believe that the world was finally done picking on the Jews. Of course, it didn't last very long, but I want to talk a little bit about those events in part two here. Anti-Semitism is gone, or is it? Three events could have contributed to post-war eradication of anti-Semitism. And they didn't, but it looked like they could have. First, in 1960, I know some of you were born, but I don't know how old you were, but I was 1 year old, so I don't remember. In 1960, Adolf Eichmann was caught in Buenos Aires, Argentina, by the Israeli intelligence agency, the Mossad. He was brought back to Israel and in 1961, tried and convicted for crimes against humanity. The absent witnesses to his heinous crimes were the 6 million Jews who perished in the Holocaust. That's a picture of Eichmann in that little booth at his trial in Israel. Eichmann was the guy that was working for Hitler, that he went to the Wannsee conference that took place in the suburb of Berlin. It was about a 90-minute get-together of some Nazi officials. We talked about that a few weeks ago. And they decided, you know, about how to implement the final solution. And he was really involved in that. So he was behind the orchestrating of a lot of the details of the Holocaust. Well, the capture of Eichmann by Mossad almost brought an international incident between Israel and Argentina. The four-month trial brought a ray of hope for some justice in a world still trying to heal from the raw wounds of the Holocaust. When Eichmann was caught, the world thought, okay, you know what? Those guys they're not going to be able to just run and have a new life. And as a matter of fact, I was reading in my research, there was a, some of you have heard the name, I'm sure, there was a doctor in the camps by the name of Josef Mengele, who did a lot of tortures and experiments on Jewish kids. And Mengele was lived in the area in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, where Eichmann lived as well. And within 2 weeks, had the Mossad arrived 2 weeks prior, they would have gotten Mengele and Eichmann, but Mengele escaped. But there have been people that have spent their entire life trying to find ex-Nazis. One comes to mind, his name is Simon Wiesenthal. You've heard of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, or the Center for Tolerance. I recommend you visit if you've never been there. I knew you would say that. You would ask that. It's Wiesenthal. Yeah, Simon Wiesenthal in Google, and you get Simon Wiesenthal. And if you also Google Museum of Tolerance, Los Angeles, it's his name, the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He passed away a few years ago. I recommend a book that he wrote that, in light of what we've done in this class, this would be a good read for you guys. It's titled The Sunflower. Anybody read it? It's hard to find. It's a hard find. Okay, if you find it, grab it. It's not very big. And the premise of the book is there's a Nazi officer that is wounded during the war, and he's in a small bed in a hospital, and there is a man who comes to work at his bedside, kind of a nurse for a short time, and the Nazi officer is really in bad shape. And the man who takes care of him happens to be, for doing forced labor, he's a Jewish man who's a nurse of some sort. So the Jewish man is at the bedside of the Nazi officers, and the Nazi officer is asking for forgiveness for what he has done to the Jewish people before he dies, to this Jewish man. And they have a little bit of a dialogue. And I'm not going to tell you, that's the first half of, it's a small book. It's the first half of the book. Their interaction, the Nazi officer asking for forgiveness of this Jewish man. I'm going to spare you the details. Then the story comes to an end. I won't tell you how, what happens between the two of them at the end. And then the best part, I think it's either 15 or 20 scholars, writers, all kinds of important people in that field write a 2 to 3 page essay on if they would have forgiven or not. From all different perspectives, it's a fabulous book, The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal. Those who made it for the longest time, if they made it for the entire time, 6 years, 7 years at the most, but nobody... I don't have any numbers on how many survived that long. I mean, people that went to the camps, moved from one camp to the next, escaped, came back. But I would say, I don't have any numbers, so I can't be dogmatic, but it would be very rare for somebody to come to a camp and survive 6 years of a... What we consider what? Because of what? I'm not sure. Like complete families completely eradicated? Of course. I mean, we don't even know. Of course, there's plenty of families. I mean, I know somebody who lost everybody in his family but one member. I mean, and that's just one person I know out of 6 million different, you know, maybe not 6 million families, but of course, plenty of that. Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the camps, you mean? Yeah, there's all kinds of history, all kinds of stories about people being saved in the camps and people fighting for other people's lives. There's all kinds of heroic stories. You can only read so much about that topic without you know you want to just end up. If you read, even I, because of the subject matter that I teach on this class and my area of expertise on anti-Semitism, if I do too much of it, I get depressed. I just get, you know, even as a believer, I have the Lord and everything, I get depressed. I just get like... Yeah, yeah. And I didn't think, you know, it's interesting because a friend of mine who kind of got me going on the subject years ago, a believer, he's back east now, he's a good friend of mine, he's a dean of a Bible school, and he's a Jewish believer, and he wrote his doctoral thesis at Dallas on the Holocaust, a theological perspective on the Holocaust. And I asked him, remember asking him about maybe 18, 20 years ago, I asked him, how often do you teach that class, because it needs to be taught? And he said, Olivier, I can only teach it once every couple of years. Because if I do it more than that, I just get in such a state of depression. I'm going like, that was like 20 years ago. I'm going like, really? I mean, it's important. It needs to be taught. And here I am doing some of what he is doing or did 20 years ago. And I'm doing some of it now. And I look all that stuff. Like I read all the stuff and I go like, okay, I got to blog on this. I got to write an article on this. And then I sit at my computer and I go like, I don't want to. No, not by everybody. Talking about Jewish people being loved, let's talk about the Pope. That was a good segue. If any. Of course, that was tongue-in-cheek, of course. All right. So, finish with Adolf Eichmann. The first thing that maybe took place that gave some hope to the world that anti-Semitism was... on the way out, Adolf Eichmann's body was similar to what they did with Osama bin Laden. Was cremated in a specially designed furnace, and his ashes were scattered over the Mediterranean Sea, beyond any territorial waters of Israel, to ensure that there could be no future memorial and that no country would be considered his final resting place. Same idea with Osama bin Laden. In his what? You know, that's a good question. That's a good question. I don't know. You ask some very good questions, and I don't have good answers. Okay, secondly, the Vatican. Now, I don't remember that either, but I was 6 when it took place. The Second Vatican, you know, Vatican II? Okay, the Second Vatican Council of 1965, Vatican II, produced a statement on the Jewish people titled Nostra Aetate, In Our Age. And the fourth section of this, actually, talks about the Jewish people. Well, the first draft of the statement was much more favorable to the Jewish people than the final statement. A clear statement was made about the common heritage that Christians and Jews had. It was mentioned that the Jews should no longer be blamed for the death of Messiah, 1965. It's about time, I would say. Seriously. And that's 46 years ago, okay? Do you think the Catholic Church has done enough damage? We've gone through 2,000 years of history here in this class. 1965, they go like, you know what? Maybe the Jews are not responsible for the death of Christ after all. Okay, 1965. But it was mentioned that Jews should no longer be blamed for the death of the Messiah and should not be represented as rejected or accursed or anathema by God. Finally, it adds that any display of anti-Semitism by anyone, anywhere, anytime is unacceptable. Paul VI, and I remember that pope, tall and skinny with big ears. I remember Paul VI. I was a kid, didn't know anything about Catholicism, but I remember Paul VI on TV. Stated in the final draft, he was ugly, but you know, nothing personal. Got to be careful, I'm being recorded here, but I'm going to get a hold, all my Catholic friends are going to call me and says, what did you say that? Okay. This is what the statement, part of the statement, this is what it said. And actually, I've got a note on the bottom of the page for the rest of the statement of Nostra Aetate on the Jewish people. Thus, the Church of Christ acknowledges that, according to God's saving design, the beginnings of our faith and our election are found already among the patriarchs, Moses and the prophets. She professes that all who believe in Christ, Abraham's sons, according to faith, Galatians 3:7, are included in the same patriarch's call, and likewise that the salvation of the church is mysteriously foreshadowed by the chosen people's exodus from the land of bondage. The church, therefore, cannot forget that she received the revelation of the Old Testament through the people with whom God, in his inexpressible mercy, concluded the ancient covenant. Nor can she forget that she draws sustenance from the root of that well-cultivated olive tree onto which have been grafted the wild shoots, the Gentiles. Wow! That's pretty right on, if you ask me for a pope. Romans 11:17-24. Indeed, the church believes that by his cross, Christ, our peace, reconciled Jews and Gentiles, making both one in himself. Ephesians 2:14-16. I did not add the scriptures. They're in part of the statement of Nostra Aetate, part 4. So, you know, it was another little good step in the right direction. Now, did that, you know, of course, when a pope speaks, as they call it, ex cathedra, it's like it's inspired by God. It's not, okay? You know, it's not. I'm just but it's what Catholics believe. It's inspired. So whatever he says is like the word of God. Yet, do you think all Catholics are going to go like, oh, Jews are okay now? Then, you know, but first of all, many Catholics don't even know what the existence of this statement right there. But for those who know that we're supposed, that Catholics are supposed to not be showing any antagonism against the Jewish people, it doesn't mean they will go along with that, okay? And of course, to this day, you find a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism in the Catholic Church, to this day. If God can bring people to himself in so many different ways. Okay, he even got this Jewish Frenchman to come to him. So, you know, there's hope. You got a Jew and a Brit who came to the Lord in this room. So that's, God has a sense of humor. And a lot of mercy too. Okay, so one more event that could have changed things a little bit was the 1967 Six Day War generated a worldwide empathy towards Israel and the Jewish people, at least in the beginning. The miracle of God that allowed Israel to push back the Soviet-equipped Arab armies might not have been acknowledged as such the world over, but it brought the world to realize that Israel, seen then, and the key word is then, as David, had succeeded in defeating the Arab Goliath. Back in 1967, the imagery was positive, but not for long. Remember, 1967 is also the coming on the scene, and we're going to talk a little bit about this in a few minutes, of Yasser Arafat. That's when he's becoming a world figure or an important figure in the Middle East. So things are about to change. These three events failed to eradicate anti-Semitism. Apparently, it was deeply rooted. The weed of Judeophobia was pulled, and for a while the longest hatred seemed to have been destroyed, but the root had remained. It was only a matter of time for a new shoot to pierce the ground of denial. Eventually, it did in the form of anti-Zionism. David, or Israel, had been turned into a new Goliath. That's the way we look at it now. Now, Israel is the Goliath, and the Palestinians are the poor little Davids that are being hurt by this giant who has no love and who wants to kill everybody. That's what you... That's the way people see it. Of course, it's not true. So, number three, anti-Zionism. Yasser Arafat... I got to tell you something funny. That won't be the first time that I try to say something funny. When I was at Moody, we took a class... We took a class, the Modern Israel, and the professor, brilliant scholar, Dr. Michael Rydelnik, we did all kinds of different ways to learn and to present our papers. And at one point, he said, "Okay, I'm going to have you team up with somebody else." Now, I was in my late 30s, early 40s, 38 through 41, when I was at Moody. Most of the kids in the classroom were like 18 through 22, okay? They didn't want to be there. I wanted to be there. So there was a little bit of a difference, but that's beside the point. So we're in this big classroom, about 40 of us, and there's a list of important people, and we have to do a biography of that important Middle Eastern person that played a role in the history of modern Israel, one way or the other. And we have to present it in a unique way, which is not a lecture or presenting a paper. It had to be very unique. So people took all kinds of people, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, Yitzhak Rabin, and then we ended up with this guy, who now works for Chosen People in Israel, with this guy, we had nothing left, and we ended up having to do our paper on Yasser Arafat. And we really didn't want to, but there was him or some obscure person, and actually, Arafat, at the time, and probably now still, there was only one authorized biography written when he was still alive. I'm sure there might be new books now that he's gone. But so we did the research on Yasser Arafat and where he was born and how he came to power and how he came to become a famous person. And we presented it. I wish we had taped the whole thing. Remember the game, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Okay, well, we had the kid was the question, the guy asking the question, and the game was called Who Wants to Be Like Yasser? Who wants to be like, and it was the same music and the same four questions, and he kept asking me, is this your final answer? And questions about who was Yasser Arafat, like 10 series of questions, and it got closer and closer to painting a big picture of who he was. We got an A. But it was funny because I was wearing a suit and a tie and the whole keffiyeh that a friend had brought me back from Israel. And so I just when I talk about him, I just always remember this, who wants to be like Yasser? So that was... No pictures, no video. You just have to take my word for it. But who would come up with this? I know. So, back to Yasser Arafat now. Yasser Arafat's arrival changed the face of the Middle East forever. Born in Cairo, now it's debated, but it's very much the truth, really, that he's not, Palestinian born. He's born in Egypt. He's an Egyptian. Okay? Born in Cairo, Egypt, Arafat spent much of his life fighting Israel, Zionism, and the Jewish people. In 59, he founded Fatah. Fatah is one of the two parties in the Palestinian Authority, now Fatah and Hamas. Fatah is more secular, in a sense more corrupt, if at all possible, than Hamas. He founded Fatah, the left-wing faction of the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, with one goal in mind, the complete eradication of Israel. That's going back to 1959. Same fight today. He was a father and a proponent of Palestinian self-determination, which is, you know, this is what he pushed, Palestinian self-determination. You are Palestinians, you belong here, you have to make a name for yourself, you have to make a country for yourself. This is what Palestinians believe today. It started back then. Back in those days, a Palestinian did not exist. You ask people there, they say, well, I'm an Arab. Where are you from? Well, I'm from Syria. I'm from Lebanon. I'm from Egypt. I'm from Jordan. I'm a Jordanian. The people that would live in the quote-unquote Palestine, that, you know, was called that back then. So prior to the coming of Arafat on the scene, Palestinian people did not exist. They simply claimed to be Arabs, I just said, and they did not view themselves as having a separate identity. 1919, as representatives were selected from the Paris Peace Conference, this statement was made. We consider Palestine as part of Arab Syria, as it has never been separated from it at any time. We are connected with it by national, religious, linguistic, natural, economic, and geographical bonds. In 1937, a local Arab leader, Oni Bey Abdul Hadi, told the Peel Commission. We talked about the Peel Commission when they were talking. You know, they were doing the after the Balfour Declaration, and when they changed things on the Jews, and then split, you know, give Palestine to the Jews and also to the Arabs, and messed it up. And so this guy at 37 said, the Peel Commission, he said, there is no such country as Palestine. Those are statements made by Arabs, okay? There's no such country as Palestine. Palestine is a term the Zionists invented. There is no Palestine in the Bible. Our country was for centuries part of Syria. So what happened here? What happened? Palestinian nationalism did not become a significant political movement until Arafat popularized it and kept pushing for it after the Six-Day War of 67. It was not an issue before. He made it an issue. He forced, not single-handedly, but he and other key people forced all these Arabs who were not Palestinian. I mean, there's no Palestinian language, Palestinian culture, Palestinian food, Palestinian history, Palestinian garb. It's all Arab food, Arab culture, Arabic language. It's not Palestinian. It's not that it doesn't exist. So, but they were forced into this land called Palestine, and then displaced from their own countries. They were there, and then they had no choice but to stay there and start families, have kids who were born in Palestine. Thus, it's their country. They know nothing else. If you're born in Jordan and you marry somebody who's from Syria, but you have your kid in Palestine and you're forced to stay there, your kid all of a sudden is raised as a little Palestinian displaced in a country that does not exist because of the Zionist monster. That's what the world is buying today. Arafat, I put a picture of him there. I had to. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I know. I just had to. Some people, when he was alive, believed that he was the Antichrist. But, he, you know, I think he was a good dry run for the Antichrist, but he was not. He popularized the headdress known as a keffiyeh. There's a picture of him wearing a keffiyeh. I don't know if you knew or not, but he always used to wear the keffiyeh in the shape of Israel to symbolize the day when Palestine will replace the Zionist state. Yeah, on the side here, if you look at the way he's always... keffiyeh, nobody but Arafat ever wore the keffiyeh only hanging on one side. He would wear it hanging on one side, clip it on his uniform in such a way that it would design the map of Israel. But the whole map of Israel as a in-your-face, you Jews, symbol of one day this will all be ours. He only wore it that way. Like the Arabs, they put the keffiyeh, you know, they put it on front of their head. It goes back on both sides with that black thing that holds it together. He wears it in a way he came up with it. I personally think it was brilliant. I don't agree with anything that this man is all about, but that he would, you know, would take it as far as wearing the garb, wearing the headdress to always say, like, you know, I mean, he believed in this cause. He was wrong. He was a monster. He's responsible for the death of many people. But he took it as far as wearing the keffiyeh in the shape of Israel. And I put the source for that too. Every picture of him you see, there's early pictures when he was not wearing the keffiyeh and he wore like sunglasses and a kind of a Fidel Castro kind of a hat. kind of like, you know, that hat, but, you know, like a khaki color, whatever, like green color, a military hat, and no keffiyeh. But as soon as he started wearing the keffiyeh, every picture in the last 30 years you see of him at different ages, he's got this thing with a map of Israel. Check it out. It's just amazing. So from that point on, the anti-Zionist propaganda I thought I skipped a page. From that point on, the anti-Zionist propaganda started to grow exponentially. Anti-Semitism was no longer driving the Judeophobic agenda of the Middle East, but anti-Zionism or anti-Israelism were. Of course, the question is there a difference? The answer is no. Zionism became racism in the eyes of pro-Palestinian countries in the Middle East, and they were able to convince much of the civilized world of the same lie. Liberal thinkers did their part in propagating the lies, and it worked. The 1975, I think we mentioned that in an earlier discussion about the UN. In 1975, a UN resolution declaring Zionism is racism was a direct result of these lies and the pressure applied to the world community. It took 16 years until 1991 for the resolution to be repealed. And it did not stop people like Yasser Arafat or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in 2009 to equate Zionism and racism at Durban 1 and Durban 2 conferences. Okay, we can add Durban 3, but they were not there. I mean, well, Ahmadinejad was there, but was not as successful as they wished it to be. Anti-Zionism has become the new approach in anti-Semitism. To be sure, there are various degrees of anti-Zionism expressed today, but all of them are definitely motivated by anti-Semitism, either consciously or unconsciously. So when you hear anti-Zionism, I was talking to my friend who's my source in France. He's a pastor, and he went to a pastor's a prayer meeting at a church, and they prayed for his ministry, and he's connected with Chosen People Ministries in France with us, and they prayed for his ministry, they prayed for Israel, they prayed for, you know, all kinds of things related to Jewish people and Jewish ministry. And one of these pastors that was at that meeting last week told them, just like that, he says, you know, I don't hate the Jews, I'm just anti-Israel and anti-Zionism. An evangelical pastor in France. And of course, when somebody tells you that, and people have told me that, you have to confront them on the spot. Not in a nasty way, like, how dare you say that? Just ask him, could you define that for me? What does it mean to be anti-Zionist? They can't. They don't know anything. It's just what's cool to say because the whole world says it. So, you know, again, cognitive dissonance. Why should I go any other way when the whole world says that, you know, anti-Zionism is the way to go because we don't hate the Jews. That's we don't do that anymore. That was done 7 years ago. 6 million died. That's really bad. Poor Jews. But really, now we hate Israel and Zionism. But who's behind Zionism? Well, the Jewish people. Most people that even understand that there is a future for Israel, it goes back to they most likely, if not certainly, take scripture allegorically. It's ignorance. But it's always, it's not, you know, when it's only ignorance, there's hope. Because when there's only ignorance, there's always the hope that you can sit down with a person and say, hey, would you care for me to explain to you from the Word and from history what really happened? Oh, I'd love to. Then there's hope. But it's usually ignorance with a certain amount of animosity and anti-Semitism, and we all have that human nature, the fallen nature of man. So, you know, we can't separate ourselves from that. Well, most anti-Israel governments or organizations have to creatively disguise their anti-Semitism in the cloak of anti-Zionism. Arab anti-Zionism doesn't try to hide the anti-Semitic agenda. It actually is quite bold about it. You've seen some of the cartoons I've showed you over the whole period of the class that we've taken here. It is worth re-mentioning that Egypt President Gamal Abdel Nasser, he was president until 1970, and King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, who died in 75, both promoted the protocols of the Elders of Zion in an effort to substantiate their anti-Zionist agenda. You remember this book? This book is going to keep coming back now when you hear conversations about anti-Semitism. Today, there are people that still promote the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the book that was the hoax written by a Russian guy in 1908. Okay, this book, since 1908, you've heard me discuss the protocols as we went through history from 1908, and now we're in 2011. You can find the book on Amazon. It's sold in anti-Semitic rallies, and it's widely distributed in Arab countries. But those two world leaders from the Middle East, Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt and King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, both promoted the protocols as they knew that it was a hoax, because it was by then, in 1921, it was recognized that book was like, it was, the whole world knew that this was a hoax, there was nothing true about it. Yet, it's still being used, and by world leaders like this, it's embarrassing. Anti-Zionism is alive and well all over the world, and it is the new weapon of both the liberal left and extreme right. See, that's another thing that you need to realize, is that back in the Nazi era, only the extreme right, the Nazi party, was after the Jews. Now we've got both sides of the spectrum, the extreme right and the liberal left, or even the extreme left. So it comes from both sides of the spectrum. One of the new dangers of anti-Zionism is its tendency to link Israel and Zionism with all Jews around the globe. We've talked about that already. Creating a crisis in many Jewish communities. The way things work nowadays is that every time the Middle East conflict surges, so does anti-Semitism around the world. Anytime there's something happening in the Middle East, you have a surge of anti-Semitic acts in France, in England, in Germany, in America, in Canada, in Australia, and everywhere you think, not just the Middle East. So something happens. If and when, I'm hoping when more than if, the Palestinian state gets vetoed, expect a big surge of acts of anti-Semitism around the globe, not just in America and Israel, around the globe. It will happen. There's no question. It will not go quietly. So that's the way it is. That's where you have to stop and say, wait a minute, you guys. Anti-Zionist, but not anti-Jew, not anti-Semitic. Explain to me why you set that synagogue on fire. What does that have to do with a decision made by the United Nations about Palestine not being a country? Why did you set that synagogue? I'm speaking of the future, not prophetically, don't panic. I'm speaking of the future because it's bound to happen. It's happened before, it'll happen again. Why did you beat up that little Jewish kid who was on his way from Jewish Shabbat school, on his way home? Why did you write those slogans on the storefront of a Jewish bakery or a kosher butcher shop? Why? What does it have to do with anti-Zionism when really Zionism is in Israel? Maybe take it as far as what happened in the United Nations, but why would you bother somebody in Poland, well, in Bulgaria, in France, in England, in South America? Why? Because anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are the same. It's just anti-Semitism in disguise. I think I made my point. But I'll make it again if you want. Part 4, the first Intifada of 1987 through 1993. Intifada is the Arabic word for uprising. So Intifada simply means the uprising. It was the so-called Palestinian uprising against Israeli occupation, quote unquote, of the Palestinian territories. The first Intifada lasted about 6 years while Israel was under the leadership of Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. It began in the Jabalaya, not Jambalaya, okay, be careful, Jabalaya I love jambalaya. Jabalaya refugee camp, largest refugee camp in the north section of the Gaza Strip, and rapidly spread throughout Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It is now a fact that the first intifada started because of a series of false allegations regarding Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. It's been investigated and it's been proven. Over 1,000 Palestinians died during the six-year conflict and more than 120,000 were arrested. The first intifada was never an official war, but through a controlled and very biased media reporting, it helped to establish the concept of the poor Palestinian victim, as pictures and videos of kids throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers who responded with guns. There was a time where this was the big thing they would show during the intifada on TV and on the news. They would show pictures, and they would just paint. They would create a story around a picture. There was a Jewish IDF soldier. I'm talking about the second intifada now, but it happened in the first and the second. There was a Jewish IDF soldier that had a baton of some sort with blood all over his hands, blood on the baton, and an American Jewish teenager on the ground, looking like this, with blood everywhere, and it was a weird picture, and it turned out that the soldier was trying to protect this kid from being killed by Palestinians, and the caption was like he was trying to kill the Palestinians who had nothing but rocks. And of course, there's the other one that we've seen on TV so many times. That little the father holding his boy at a street corner, and the boy being killed by a stray bullet or whatever. Turns out that the French reporter, leave it to the French again. The French reporter recently had to admit that he made it up. It was impossible that one of those CSI ballistic thing, you know, where when they looked at it from an unbiased angle. No pun intended, they realized the bullet could have not killed the boy. And then you have a lot of pictures on the news where you have little boys, you know, with a keffiyeh around their head, like the picture I showed you here on page 7, throwing rocks at the mean IDF soldier with machine guns. And then the camera takes a picture at the IDF soldier and the kid with the rocks, trying to defend themselves with little rocks. How can you do that? It's terrible. It's so unequal, unjust. And then if you scope out of the field to get the whole picture, right behind the little kids, you see a bunch of Palestinians with guns. I've got footage, you guys, okay? It exists. It's on videos. It's on movies. This is a reality. Why is the world so blinded? Why is it the world so stupid? Unless really the world is a lot more anti-Semitic than we want to admit. I don't know. I mean, I'm not talking about conspiracy theory here, but I'm telling you, it's pretty bad. And both intifadas happened that way. Yes. Well, in universities, most, if not all, of the university professors are liberals, and they're going to rewrite history. They're going to rewrite, and they're lying. Yeah. Yes, but then there's lying by omission and lying by commission, and I think they're lying by commission, not omission. You know, omission is when you just make a mistake. Commission is when you want to make that mistake. That's when you're really guilty. Jewish mafia, yeah. Jewish mafia, yeah. I'm going to make you a kosher offer you can't refuse. Okay, all right. So, let's... He's going to what? Yeah. All right, the second intifada, also known as the Palestinian War, not much different from the first. On September 28, 2000, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon visited the Temple Mount. By the way, when you decided to visit the Temple Mount, it was not one of those, hey, I'm just going to go for a walk and visit the Temple Mount. He called the authority. He called, hey, we're going to come with a small delegation and visit the Temple Mount. He let them know. It was a known thing. They knew he was coming, okay? And the rocks that they started to throw from the top of the Temple Mount right straight down to the worshippers at the Kotel, at the Western Wall, as the start of that Intifada, was unorganized, when you, when it just happens, what's the word? When something happens out of the blue and it's not organized, it's not prepared, it's... What? Out of the blue. Well, it appeared to be not impromptu, but anyway, I'll find the word at 3 in the morning. I'll call you. It appeared to be completely out of the blue, unprepared, like a reaction to Ariel Shore, spontaneous. That'll work. But it was not, because there were piles of rock right behind the wall that. I mean, you know, if it's spontaneous, you throw a few rocks, there's some time between because you got to find more, you throw chairs, whatever. They had piles of rocks behind the walls, and they threw them for a while. So it was not spontaneous. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Far cry from impromptu.
It was premeditated.
It was premeditated and not spontaneous. Thank you to both of you. He did not do so to exacerbate the Palestinian Authority, but simply to visit Judaism's holiest site. Within a couple of weeks, Palestinians destroyed the holy site of Joseph's tomb in Nablus and attacked Rachel's tomb in Bethlehem, as well as continued to throw rocks at worshippers at the Western Wall. None of the attacks were initiated by the IDF troops, but instead by Arafat's own militia, known as the Tanzim. The uprising is known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada and is responsible for the death of 5,500 Palestinians and about 1,100 Israelis. Recently, it has been renamed the Palestinian War. It appeared that the immediate catalyst for the Intifada was the breakdown of the Camp David negotiations of July 2000 between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat. By the way, at that time, Yasser Arafat had 92% of everything they ever wanted in his hand. He had 92% of all they wanted in his hand. He could have signed the agreement and he would have had 92% of all of Israel. The only thing that they would not give away was Jerusalem. And he knew that he could not go back to the Middle East and tell the Fatah and his people, we got it all except for Jerusalem, because they're not interested in any of it unless it's all of it with no Jews. Do not be fooled. So he came back and he said, not going to work. They had 92%. They could have taken 92%. Not going to work. Not enough. Because still, they're not interested in a two-state solution. As unequal as a two-state might be 90% Palestine, 10% Israel. God forbid. They're not interested in that. Yeah. Yeah, seriously. Well, it's a longer. That's why it is not geographical. It's not geopolitical. It's not financial. It's a spiritual battle. And Satan is behind it. It's a spiritual battle. Both intifadas also included Palestinians killing their own. It continues to this day, by the way. Palestinians killing their own for various reasons, and this has been known. That I did not know. I found out recently. This has been known as, it's a made-up word, as the intrafada. Intrafada, like intranet, you know, intrafada. So the intifada means the uprising. The intrafada means the internal uprising between factions of Palestinians that disagree on something. So they kill their own, but we already knew that. The two intifadas were violent Palestinian reactions to the so-called Zionist occupation, quote, end quote. Both times, surges of anti-Semitic acts were witnessed around the world, as the Jewish people were now corporately held responsible for whatever happens in the Middle East and continues to this day. The world continues to feel sorry for the poor Palestinian victims. To be sure, the Middle East conflict, like all conflicts, is inflicting pain and loss to many people. We shouldn't make any attempt at diminishing its effect on both Israelis and Arabs. But biased reporting, coupled with continued anti-Semitism, paint an unnecessary picture of Israel as the perpetrator of the Middle East monstrosities. Most of the world is now conditioned to see Israel as the roadblock to the Middle East peace process. Anti-Semitism continues, but it has now morphed into a new beast, the new anti-Semitism. And this, we'll have to wait until next week to discuss the new anti-Semitism. Thank you.